been tied into deep into the motivation, the deep motivation for the negotiation and treaty about space rather early on in the history of space. We were in the middle of the Cold War. Both the US and the Soviet Union considered outer space as a strategic icon. This had a very strong link with nuclear deterrence and not only for surveillance and targeting of nuclear weapons, but also for telecommunication, positioning of the submarines and all that. The priority at the staff level, the general staff level, was we have to prevent a surprise attack, and in order to prevent a surprise attack, we know what the other guys do. I started with a few tables, which you cannot read, but just remember, each dot on this table is one launch of an observation satellite by the Soviet Union between 1960 and 1980. First layer is the first generation, second layer is second generation, etc., etc. I'm not going to go into the details, but what is very striking is a huge number of launches which took place. One reason why, simply that the satellites did not last for very long. And some of them were actually carrying cameras with the old style films, not broadcasting their data to the ground station, and therefore the capacity for observation was limited. And that explains why so many satellites were launched. It's just unbelievable how many launches took place during those years. And this continued at a less high level in the 80s until the 2000s. But of course, when you see the red bars at the bottom, it means the photographic technique has been abandoned and the data was digital and transmitted to the ground station by digital techniques. Now on the US side, it was quite impressive too. Maybe not quite as high as in the Soviet Union, but still very high from the 1960 to the 1970 with a very large number of keyhole satellites, spy satellites, also carrying photographic films for many, many years, and the transmission by digital techniques took place from the 80s onwards, and that is why it explains why in this last chart on the you see less number, smaller number of satellites being launched by the US from 1980 onwards. So just remember, we are talking of very large number of satellites launched in the early years. And this is only for observation. If I switch to early warning, we had a similar situation. Early warning satellites were mostly in the geo orbit because you need to watch over what's going on the Earth, watch for missile taking off in particular. The top part of this chart shows the early warning satellite launched by the Americans, and the bottom part of the chart shows the early warning satellites launched by the Soviet Union. This, again, is a very, very large number of satellites. Well, clearly the superpowers at the time had a vested interest in keeping outer space free of restriction, which might limit the use of outer space by their own forces. On top of this very military-grounded motivation, there was also the push from the scientific community to have a wide access to outer space as a base for exploration. So the civilian side was initially also pushing for space, outer space without restriction. That led to a certain number of principles being agreed and written into law in the treaty signed in 1967. And I'm saying that in very simple terms, not in legal terms, I'm sure Said will object to the way I'm describing the principles, but that your turn will come, Said. Non-national appropriation of space or part of space or celestial bodies. Equal access, at least in principle, to all nations. freedom of circulation, freedom of data collection, no deployment of weapons of mass destruction. That is clearly stated in Article 4. Military activities are forbidden on the moon and other celestial bodies, but they are not forbidden in space. They are only forbidden on the surface of celestial bodies. And also, very important, states are responsible for activities in outer space conducted by their nationals, whether they are government or private companies. Very important part too. Well, these principles have been supported quite well over the years by all spacefaring nations. Today we have a treaty which has been ratified by 105 states, at least the latest information that I have. And fortunately some states which do conduct space activities have not ratified. And one particular case to note is Colombia. Colombia signed the treaty but never ratified. And why is it that Colombia has not ratified? Well, in the Constitution of Colombia, there is an article which says that they actually own the equatorial orbit at the geostationary altitude. And this is, of course, in contradiction with the Outer Space Treaty. 9 countries and 1 regional orbiting, the European one, have an orbital launch capability or have demonstrated, I don't know. But it's important to note that actually, this number, only 6 of them do regular launch of spacecraft, and these are those which are underlined on the on this slide. Even Israel, they launch once in a while, but the rhythm of launching is very, very low. This of course is what it is today, but because of the development of private launch operators, which is really coming up, we expect that this list will probably be extended over the next few years. But we have launch bases in a number of places, as shown on this slide. Some of these launch bases have been closed or are not in operation. For example, Boomerang in Australia or the Alcantara base in Brazil has actually never launched a satellite into orbit. But there is an infrastructure there. And this is also the case in some of the former Soviet Union bases. San Marco is a platform off the coast of Kenya, which was used for a few scout launches in the early days, in the 60s and 70s, but is not used anymore. In fact, this map should show the Hamagir launch base that France used to have in Sahara, in Algeria, but has been closed when Algeria became independent. And the bottom right shows the distribution of space activities according to civilian or military activity, with of course a strong military part in Soviet Union, and now Russia, and in the US. In 2017, we count about 60 countries which have at least one satellite in orbit. It doesn't mean they launch the satellite, but they own and operate the satellite in orbit. But of course, the distribution of investment varies very much from the US, which is, you know, this number, this table comes from OECD and is already a little bit outdated, is 2013. They quote $39 billion for the U.S. budget. I believe it's much larger than that today. China, they come up with a number, which I must say I'm very happy that they have come up with a number. Nobody is able to come up with a number for the Chinese space budget. But anyway, here they put $11 billion. That's significant. And the column on the right of the left table shows the budget per capita. And of course, the budget per capita in the US is very large, $123 per American citizen. and in China it's very low, $7.9 per city. On the right part of the slide, you will see the space, the government space budget as a share of GDP. And it's interesting to know that the Russian ratio is higher than the US. And you know why? Because the GDP of Russia has gone down. And therefore, with a budget which is not so large, but still significant, the ratio to GDP is higher, about 0.25% of GDP in Russia, while it is 0.24 so in the US. And again, to note on this slide, more interestingly, is the increase in China from 2013 from 2008 to 2013. You seem to show a decrease, which did not really happen. So this, in my view, is simply indicating the lack of reliability of the numbers when it comes to the Chinese space budget. Very, very difficult to know exactly how much is spent. We know it is significant, but to pinpoint a number, again, is difficult. These are numbers from OECD. Let's review briefly the main actors. The US, of course, is by far, is dominating the scene. Its space expenditure is the largest, plus they have gone to the moon. Nobody else has, at least with the crew. But keep in mind that the civilian part of the American budget is a smaller part. The military part is much larger. It is very high. In 2010, it was almost 7% of the total defense budget. And you know the defense budget of the US is very large. 7% of the defense budget goes into space assets. Very, very large. In fact, people sometimes quote, I'm not so sure about the number, but they say the US space expenditure in defense asset is 60 or so percent of the world expenses in space asset for defense purposes. It is very large anyway. Compared to this situation in the US, Russia, they are trying very hard to rebuild this space capability. It used to be really at the in the Cold War, not the same level as the US. It's no longer at the same level. They have a vast experience, they have industry, but they have difficulty to modernize at the rate that they need to. They have beautiful achievements in the past. Here you see the Mir station in the middle and the astronauts, the cosmonauts, I should say, going up on the Soyuz rocket. But today, when you look at the details of what's going on in Russia, you find that Russia is really putting the priority to their military space asset. And the civilian part of the program is not so well supported. China, of course, is a new actor, very, very, very active, very ambitious. And this curve here shows the number of Chinese launches from 1970, when they started, up to 2012. And this, again, is a very significant increase in activity on the part of China. The reddish part of the moon shows the manned space flight of China. China is publishing a space policy paper with an update about every 5 years. Of course, it's written in a style that is a bit difficult to understand and to read in between the lines. What's important to know is that the People's Liberation Army, that is the defense people, plays a strong role. And in particular, they manage the manned space part of the Chinese program. The manned space part is ambitious, but they take it with a lot of caution. They go, not too fast. They don't want to have any failure, so they take their time. India, of course, is also another actor in Asia, which is, in fact, has been around for a long time in China. They have a very active program, mostly dedicated so far at least to civilian purpose. It used to be very focused on applications to the development of their own country, but now they are expanding into space exploration. The point that is interesting is that their very reliable polar launch vehicle, PSLV, is now on the market, and a lot of their of the launches are now for outside customers. They are, some of you may know that earlier this year, they had one launch of PSLV with 100 nanosatellites. 100 nanosatellites, and it worked well. Japan is also a major actor in Asia. It has a very strong science community and a very successful science project. They have some ambition into the commercial launch market, but they have found it very difficult to actually find customers for the launcher. The picture shows an H1, but now they are running H2. In the recent past, the new development that has taken place in Japan, and to be noted, is that they have now deployed what they call intelligence gathering satellites. So they have now a small military side of their space activity, which is not managed by the JAXA, not by the space agency, but directly by the Prime Minister's office. What about Europe? Well, in Europe, we have been active for a while, a long time. These two pictures show some activity take place very early on. But to your right, you see a Diamant A launch in December 65 from Amagir in Algeria. And to your left, you see the Symphony telecommunication satellite, which was a joint venture between France and Germany, launched in 74-75. But later on, as we know, we organized ourselves in Europe through the European Space Agency, and this has been very successful. You have a launch of Ariane 1 on 24th of December 1979 as a symbol of success of the European Space Program. And to your right, you have a Meteosat image from the first Meteosat that I launched in 1977. Very successful venture too. What we have today is a bit complex situation where the EU in Brussels is trying to take over the traditional role played by the European Space Agency for civilian space program. At least they're trying to establish the policy, to establish the strategy of the European space. This is not entirely successful, to tell you the truth, even though they have invested into the Galileo satellite and into the Copernicus program. The rest of this space activity remains managed by the European Space Agency. And why? Well, it's simple, because the member states are quite happy with the way it works. And they don't want the EU to destroy something that works well and has worked well so far. So I see in the future the ESA continuing to do the work that the member states want them to do, and in fact I understand that the UK will continue to be part of ESA even after Brexit. So this is a good indication that the UK also is apparently satisfied with the way ESA operates. So this is, I would say, a positive mechanism that we have found, which is always a big surprise for people outside of Europe. Whenever we're visitors from outside of Europe and we explain to them how it works in ESA and how we are able to do a cooperative program, they look at us and say, but how can you manage that? It's not possible. But it is possible. Well, thanks to the provision of the OST, in part, many other emerging and developing countries have become very active in space. Mostly, not only, but mostly by the deployment of their own micro or mini satellites. In some cases also with telecommunication satellites serving communication network in a country. So I have a list here of countries who have their own satellites. This list is not complete. I'm sure we could probably add 20 or 30 more countries, but these are those shaped to my mind. It is significant because the list is increasing every day. You see new spacecraft being launched. For example, 2 days ago, a Long March launcher launched a communication satellite for Algeria, all funded more or less by Chinese development aid. So this is significant. I think we can say that it's because the principles of the Outer Space Treaty, they have served the community, the international community, quite well. And nobody has actually tried to modify that, at least so far. Now, I'm coming to a part of my talk that I'm going to skip, because otherwise I will not be on time. So let me skip one part, because I want to say a few words about night space. The OST, the Outer Space Treaty, declares astronauts as envoys of mankind in outer space, and as such, they deserve special protection. Of course, it's a very specific part of space activities. And if you look back, manned space programs were mostly driven by strategic consideration during the Cold War. And if you look today at what China is doing, it is also a strategic consideration. China is demonstrating their capability, their technological advance and their capability by flying man in space. This is not so much towards the US or Russia and so on. They want to demonstrate these strengths to their neighbors, to the rest of Asia. And they are very successful. I have to say that there is some disappointment with the limited spin-offs from the International Space Station, which has been the major investment in manned space over the last 20 years. And it is a fact that it has cost a lot of money, mostly to the American taxpayer, by the way. But it's not very clear what will come next. Well, what comes next, I don't know exactly, although President Trump decided 2 days ago to sign a directive saying go back to the moon. Probably that is a reasonable step, I would say. But in general, I would say simply that the urge to go beyond the horizon, to explore the solar system with manned mission, will remain very strong. The Outer Space Treaty, in fact, refers repeatedly to the word exploration and use of outer space. And this reflects the fact that those who wrote the Outer Space Treaty were writing the treaty at a time where the word exploration space was a generic term, say, covering both exploration, as we call it today, and use of outer space. However, and this will be the last part of my presentation, we have to also consider that there are some negative sides of all this development. Space has developed very well. The number of nations involved has developed, as we have seen earlier. But we have a situation of crowding. It's a bit like a traffic in London. In London, you are trying to solve that by asking people to pay to come into the center of London. Maybe that will come one day when it comes to the low Earth orbit. We have crowding taking place, both in the low Earth orbit and in geostationary altitude. That creates risk of interference and even risk of physical collision. The management of these orbital and spectrum resources is becoming a bit of a headache. And this is mostly done by the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union, at least with respect to the radio frequency management. And we have this problem of proliferation of space debris, which is becoming a real problem. Probably you know about all that, so I will not spend too much time, but just remember, we have about 1,200 operational satellites in orbit. About half of them are on the geo ring, so about half between the low Earth orbit and the geostationary altitude, with a few in between at the Galileo, GPS, LONASS altitude. But we have many more, which are debris. Which are debris generated by the launch activity, generated by satellites at the end of the life, some of them explode, generated by upper stage of rockets, which are either still there or possibly have even exploded and generated their own debris. So this is a real problem. Just a reminder of the size of the problem. And this is a curve of the number of objects being tracked from the beginning of this space era until 2009. Unfortunately, the curve is continuing over the last few years. And this one was developed, statistics was developed by ESA at their European Space Operations Center in Darmstadt. On this figure, what is important is that the bottom part is all rocket debris. The green part is spent debris. The purple part is rocket bodies. And the actual payloads are only the top part in is that orange?
Does it look orange here?
Orange.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure what the color showing on the screen is not the same. And, okay, very good. So we have a risk of collision, even between operational satellites. I just want to give you a concrete example. Between the NASA Terra Cloud Satellite, Aura Earth Observation Satellite, which are on the same orbit, following each other on the same orbit, between these three satellites and the China Xijian satellite, there is a risk of collision. There is a close approach every month. Close approach means, you know, less than 15 miles or 15 kilometers. There are risks which are difficult to manage. There is also the risk of outer space becoming a battlefield. Deployment of weapons apparently has not taken place, but we are not so sure of that. There may be some weapons in outer space, but we don't know. However, ground-based weapons are on the surface of the Earth, and sometimes they are used. And in the last few years, some highly mobile inspection satellites have been launched and tested in orbit by the US, by Russia, and by China. And this is also a source of worry. Overall, I would say the legacy of the Outer Space Treaty is extremely positive. But it's not quite enough. We need to be able to develop and agree on new international mechanisms to ensure a safe and sustainable use of outer space. That's what I wanted to tell you this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll have to move on. We'll take the questions later. I'm sure there'll be some. Our next speaker, it seems entirely appropriate to ask the Director of the Institute of Space Policy and Law, Saeed Moshtar, to tell us about the current status of the OST. While Saeed is coming up here, I would say in your handout there is more details about these individuals who you're going to see for your information, so it will save you some time reading them.
Yes, indeed. And also, I should mention that you will get a much fuller description of the vast experience of all these people after the seminar, and we will send you a report also of the proceedings of today. But I'm very glad that there are mentioned in closing that What is